Thank you very much, and good afternoon. This is an unusual audience for me to actually address, and it's probably a somewhat unusual topic for many of the people in the audience, although some of you have actually probably had a CT scan at some stage and have some idea of what it's like, or some family member has had one. But what we're going to talk about today clearly is the use of whole body CT imaging and post-mortem detection of elder abuse and neglect. I'd like to say a little bit about the background of our centre and how this came about, and just give you a little bit of perspective on this. We've had a collaboration running, a forensic imaging initiative running between my department and the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner for the State of Maryland since 2006. Only a couple of years, but this has been quite a successful collaboration, and we'll give you a little bit of background about it. There are quite a number of people in my own department who actually contribute to this process, and perhaps the group I'd recognize most are actually the bottom line there, the CT technologists and MR technologists, who actually are the ones who physically scan the decedent's bodies, wrapped in body bags. And this has actually been something that we've had just wonderful cooperation with from our colleagues in CT technology in particular, as they've done most of it. And then on the other side of the street, literally, we have the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner for the State of Maryland, and he and a number of his MD and other colleagues have helped, and the group especially who've been especially helpful are the forensic investigators, who actually are legally charged with care of the body at all times. To give you a little bit of background about where all this started, whole body computed tomography, or CT as we call it for short, the use of imaging and what we sometimes refer to as the virtual autopsy, you may hear this expression, was initially developed in the first half of this decade at the University of Bern in Switzerland as a collaboration of forensic pathologists, medical examiners, and radiologists to try to introduce advanced imaging into routine forensic medicine practice. There have been, as the scanners that we've got have become more powerful, and we now have the ability to do more 3D imaging of the whole body. The applications that have been used in the living body, of course, we can now scan the heart in just a couple of seconds. We can scan the brain in a couple of seconds. We can do a lot of things that we were never able to do before. But it certainly struck a number of people that really there was probably a huge role for imaging in the forensic medicine setting. In this country, there have been some research initiatives. One started off at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology here in DC, and also at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where CT scans have been performed on all of the military casualties who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan in the last 5 years, and a large amount of data has been accumulated, both to determine the cause of death and also to try to determine whether it might be possible to actually avoid major casualties in the future by, for example, determining if body armor is inadequate, or looking at looking at the results of explosives like IEDs. How does it actually kill people? Because there is information we can get from 3D imaging of the body that's actually kind of tough to actually get from a conventional autopsy. There have been a couple of civilian initiatives, our own one at the University of Maryland, and other small initiatives both at the University of Pennsylvania and University of Michigan. But in fact, we're actually relatively behind the curve, because most of the other countries in the list at the bottom there have been doing this for a number of years, particularly in places such as Japan, because in Buddhist culture, doing an autopsy on the body after death is considered a very inappropriate thing to do, unless it's absolutely mandated in a suspected criminal case. But other countries are actually way ahead, and we can actually see an image there of a body in a body bag, actually on a CT scanner, which, if the scanner is essentially the same as one would use for someone who's still alive. Just to give you a couple of examples of what we've been trying to answer with respect to different problems, is that can CT or MR imaging either augment or completely replace the autopsy? And this is one such example blunt accidental trauma. This is the victim of a high-speed MVA. It was actually somebody who got hit by a train, and you can see that they have massive skull injuries. We can see lots of fractures on the image on over here. We can see multiple fractures. Within the brain itself, we can actually see that there is a large amount of gas, and there's actually even, I'm sorry, we're going a little fast, there's actually even some blood. And down in the corner, that's what a normal brain should look like day one after death. So you can actually, I think, appreciate there's a big difference, because there's a lot of swollen traumatic effect upon that brain, which is certainly consistent with the sudden death that occurred. Just a couple of other examples. These are, it's another case, but multiple skull fractures, and you can see what the arrows are actually pointing out, all of the different fractures that are actually present. The view, colored view over on your right, is actually what we'd sometimes refer to as a virtual dissection view, because this is essentially what the skull base looks like if the pathologist, I'm sorry, it keeps jumping ahead, if the pathologist actually took the top off the skull and actually removed the brain and looked inside, this is exactly what he would see. So this is sometimes referred to as a virtual dissection view. Here's a third case. This was a victim of a high-speed MVA, got hit by a truck, and multiple severe injuries are present. We can see there are lots of fractures in the pelvis. I can just point out a couple here, and I don't think I'm going to actually bother you trying to use the scroll at all. But if we actually look at this image of the lower limb, I think you don't need to be a physician, you don't need to be a radiologist to appreciate the number of fractures that are actually present here. So this really was a severely traumatized body. There is actually a trauma inside the brain. There's trauma in the image of showing you the chest over on the left as well. And it's probably not that surprising that the driver was dead at the scene. So this is an example of where really imaging can really replace an autopsy, because frankly, I think I ask you the question, do you really need any more information regarding what actually caused death? And I think the answer is certainly not in the setting of accidental death, although we're not here to discuss that today. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Maryland covers the entire state, and it's actually on the University of Maryland Medical Campus. And we're exceptionally lucky in that sense that we actually have a one-state system. Many other jurisdictions around the country, as we all know, are very fragmented and maybe much smaller, and we are exceptionally lucky in that respect. Which does mean that we are actually a good center to actually do research because of the economies of scale. There clearly are logistical challenges when actually scanning decedents in a medical center, which is what we've had to do, because we don't actually have a CT scanner in the medical examiner's office yet. That's coming. But we do actually scan the bodies usually in the early hours of the morning when the scanners are quiet, and in an area which doesn't have access to the general public. So that's actually a very practical thing for us to do. But we've got to really be careful to make sure that we have a rule that the deceased must always wait for the living, and we have to be careful about that. But we've had tremendous support from both our hospital and our department administration, because they essentially have allowed us to do all of this initial research at no cost, because they've considered it as being public service, and for that reason have been agreeable to doing it. And as I've said, we've had tremendous cooperation and interest with our technologists and with the chief medical examiner's staff, who are responsible for selecting all of the cases and a lot of the other work involved, and the investigators who take care of the bodies when they're actually being brought to the university hospital from the medical examiner's office and back again. Just to give you a brief overview of all the things that we do, this is the list of potential indications. It's pretty long, and we'll just move on from there to this slide, which actually points out in green all of the things that we've been doing at Maryland, including blunt trauma, especially either accidental or non-accidental, penetrating trauma, particularly ballistics, which of course is 9 out of 10, 99% of the time is non-accidental. I'm trying to identify the unidentified bodies which are occasionally found. We are also very interested in suspected non-accidental injury in children. We do not do any suicide cases, but we've certainly done drowning cases, we've done burns cases, we've done unknown causes of death, and of course we have now got a research project on suspected elder abuse. Just to very briefly talk about one area that, of course, might interest this audience, and that is the setting of doing research into suspected non-accidental injury in young children. We are particularly interested in looking for the injuries that may occur as a result of shaking of the child, of the young child. So we're looking for evidence of brain hemorrhage, retinal hemorrhage, bone fractures, soft tissue injuries, and indeed internal organ injuries, all of which may be manifestations of abuse. And we found that MRI is the best test to actually do for these young children. And we have a very high resolution research scanner for MRI. This is a very, very powerful one. And we can actually see one such example showing a sagittal view of the brain in a young child who was actually, the question of non-accidental injury was raised, but this actually turned out to be a sudden infant death syndrome, as we found an entirely normal body without any evidence of abuse in this case. Unfortunately, we do see cases that are abused, and this is actually a CT scan showing a possible optic nerve hemorrhage in a suspected pediatric non-accidental injury death. So this is a CT scan just showing the two eyes, and the pink arrow is actually showing a thickened optic nerve, and that's a concern for hemorrhage. But CT is not great for showing us hemorrhage. And one of the things we'd really like to know is, can we detect this optic nerve hemorrhage before we actually have a child in the medical examiner's office? We really would prefer to see and identify these injuries when the child is still alive, and hopefully maybe an intervention may be possible. Unfortunately, this is actually a child who subsequently died of their injuries, and what we're actually now doing is actually with a high resolution, what we call a micro MRI scanner, we're actually looking for evidence of retinal and optic nerve hemorrhage in suspected pediatric non-accidental injury. If you actually look at the image in the far corner on the right side, the yellow arrows are actually pointing to a dark area along the optic nerve, and that's actually hemorrhage along the optic nerve. And one of the things we want to be able to see is, what's the best way to detect it? How can we find it? Can we actually find it before anyone else can find it? Because if hemorrhage starts inside the brain, and we can actually identify it in the optic nerves, that may be very, very helpful. And this actually, unfortunately, is research that is being done on the eyes, the extracted eyes of dead children who unfortunately have been the victims of fatal abuse. But this is just another aspect of the research we do. However, after all of that preamble, I would like to talk about the matter in hand, which is the project which we're doing, which is investigating the utility of whole body CT imaging and post-mortem detection of elder abuse and neglect. And we are comparing it to and addressing potential substitution for standard autopsy. And this is just an update on this project, which is still very much works in progress, but I'm very pleased to at least have an opportunity to share some information with the audience on this. Our initial work consisted of the development of an optimum whole body CT scan protocol technique for evaluating these potentially abused elder decedents based upon our center's prior accrued experience in scanning deceased victims of blunt and penetrating trauma, and indeed in pediatric abuse. So very roughly how things go, if we follow the arrows, I'm not trying to teach you the physics of CT scanning, other than to point out that we start off in the top corner with a decedent in a body bag in a CT scanner, and they will actually travel through the CT scanner, and images will be generated from 365 degrees. Let's see if we can actually use our pointer. We take images of the body from 360 degrees from every angle. And of course, all of that information subsequently goes into a powerful computer, which allows us to generate images of the body in virtually all planes. We have the axial or transverse image over on your left, and then the coronal or frontal view is the next one which we can generate. And then we can generate sagittal views. This is actually a view, obviously, of the neck. And then we can actually extract certain tissues. For example, we can extract the bones. This is actually extracting all the ribs, and we can actually see there's a clear evidence of a fracture of the humerus in the upper arm on the right side. We can actually see that right there. So this is just a very sort of very quick overview of actually how the scanning actually works without going into any detail. Now, I was told there might be one or two lawyers in the audience, so I thought I'd better put a fine print slide in, but just joking. This is our protocol, which you don't really need to know about, but just to tell you that we scan the entire body in thin sections in 1 millimeter intervals, which actually generates at least a couple of thousand images from each scan, and we use 3D imaging in every case to actually optimize the different views that we take of each part of the body. To date, we have actually scanned and actually got conventional autopsy data on 37 out of an approved cohort of 80 decedents, so we're not quite at the halfway mark, unfortunately. This, unfortunately, has been a project which has taken longer to generate data from than we would like. We use 2D and 3D images in each case, and all studies are interpreted by two radiologists individually and by consensus. The CT and autopsy findings have been determined blindly without knowledge of the other study in each case. As I stated, we haven't actually got to the halfway point. We are planning, because this project has taken longer than we had hoped, that once we do get to 40, that we will actually analyze and hopefully publish at least half of the cohort, and then continue on to accrue more cases to finally reach a total of 80, which we will be able to do over time, but it's taking longer than we would really like. Why would this delay? Well, the case accrual has certainly been slower than anticipated, and the projected volume of cases, which I'm afraid I have to blame my medical examiner colleagues for telling me that we would have no difficulty accumulating 80 cases in 2 years, but that unfortunately has not turned out to be the case, because I think they are actually applying criteria relatively carefully. And then one of the other questions we have, of course, is whether those cases of abuse that we know are out there are actually even being referred to our medical examiners or not. We had, unfortunately, some delay in CT interpretations due to a serious family health reason for one of our trained radiologists, and we have to actually get this new person retrained, which has delayed things more recently. Why the slow case accrual? There may be other reasons, such as the known cyclical variations in the incidence of this crime, or perhaps, as I said, more careful application of inclusion criteria. What we have done, though, with NIJ approval is to expand the study to include suspected cases of abuse of decedents who are less than 65 years of age but greater than 18 years, who are residents in long-term care facilities in whom abuse has been alleged. So we actually have recently accumulated several cases that fit into that age range, although the vast majority are in the over 65 age range, and certainly fit into the elder category. Just to actually look at some preliminary results, and some of this information is very preliminary, but we've only had an opportunity to actually correlate the conventional autopsy and CT imaging findings in 20 of our 37 cases so far. No findings suspicious for elder abuse have been identified reliably on either test so far, and all deaths have been determined by the medical examiners as natural. The medical examiners in our medical examiner's office work by consensus. They actually have rounds where a minimum of 10 of them will do rounds on all of the cases of the day, both in the morning and then after autopsy and other investigations have taken place, including scanning, and will make their determination as by consensus. And so far, none of these cases have actually been identified as definite cases of elder abuse. The major causes of death that have been identified, and some of these overlap because more than one cause of death occurred, include cardiac most often, pulmonary embolism, chest infections frequently, head injuries, and neurologic events such as stroke, and one accidental medication overdose. Some of the things that we've seen on scanning that are actually have been of note have been the presence of multiple acute rib fractures seen in 10 out of the 37 cases. All of them were bilateral and upper anterior locations of the chest, and all had been associated with attempted cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And this is actually something we can talk about a little bit more in a minute. There were a couple of cases where we saw long-standing rib fractures, but we didn't see any case where we saw what would be a typical suspicious mixture of both recent and old fractures in the setting of somebody who had been abused over a period of time. Osteoporotic compression fractures of the spine were noted in 8 cases, and these are actually, again, very frequent events which occur in the elderly, which, of course, do not really correlate well with abuse as we know it. This is an example of a case where there were multiple fractures which were associated with an attempted resuscitation, and in fact there was actually some bleeding identified within the chest, which you've marked on in that pink arrow demonstrating some bleeding occurring within the chest. When we actually looked at the ribs in detail, we were able to identify multiple fractures, both on a 3D image over on your left and a 2D image on your right. And those rib fractures are very, very commonly seen in osteoporotic elderly patients. I can certainly, personal experience of this when, as a medical intern, I was responsible for actually breaking multiple ribs in an elderly gentleman who actually had a cardiac arrest on the floor. But the response of my senior colleague when I told him, because I felt very guilty about it, was, in an elderly person and you're doing resuscitation, sometimes you have to break eggs to make omelets. Now, the fact that this unfortunate patient made an excellent recovery and walked out of the hospital 2 weeks later did make me feel somewhat better, but I can always remember that feeling that, oh my God, but elderly osteoporotic bones do unfortunately fracture very easily when you attempt to resuscitate patients. That's well known. So this is something that I think we're going to see more of in this particular patient population. There were some discordant findings, however. There was one case of a neck fracture and dislocation that was not seen at autopsy, which was seen on CT, and one case of a grade 4 decubitus ulceration not seen at autopsy. There were 2 cases of grade 1 to 2 decubitus ulceration not seen at CT, which is perhaps not surprising because CT's not good at finding the very superficial ulcers, and one case of neck fracture which was not seen at CT but called at autopsy, but even going back in it, it just looks like severe degenerative disease to us, so we're really not quite sure of what we missed. Here's one case which was a fracture dislocation through the C4 and C5 vertebral body with the yellow arrows pointing out the fractures on both a lateral and a frontal view. What was surprising was that, initially surprising to me, was that this was actually overlooked at autopsy, but when we actually talked to the medical examiners about it, they said, well, the reason is because there was severe rigor mortis in this particular case, and when rigor is present, the neck examination may be very difficult because everything's very, very stiff, and the reality is that the dissection of the spine is very difficult for in as part of the autopsy. They don't routinely do it unless they have an index of suspicion on the basis of either their clinical examination or some other information that they have regarding the case. It can take absolutely hours to dissect through the spine to actually find these fractures, and if they had been suspicious and found a lot of mobility in the neck, they would have definitely have done a dissection, but they didn't. So this is actually something where, again, the CT scan may show things that the autopsy doesn't, and that's actually been our experience also, or elsewhere, if you will, not just in elder abuse. This is a case of discordant findings where a C5 vertebral fracture, which is outlined in yellow, was seen on autopsy only. We still think it looks like degenerative disease, and this was a patient who actually died of a subarachnoid hemorrhage from a fall. The pink arrows are showing small areas of bleeding on the view of the CT scan of the head, which we see there. There were discordant findings with respect to decubitus ulcers, and this was not actually read as this was described as stage 2 decubitus ulcer by autopsy, but we can clearly see that there is actually some very deep ulceration present. The yellow arrows are outlining that, and the pink arrow is actually outlining chronic bone involvement, which again CT is very good at finding, but that can actually be difficult for the medical examiner to determine, and this is why we can detect the osteomyelitis infective changes more easily than the conventional autopsy can. And finally, just to show that sometimes we actually do identify a clear cause of natural death, this was a case of cardiac tamponade where acute leak of blood actually occurs from the heart into the surrounding sac, very typically occurs in the setting of acute myocardial infarction and blood loss, and the yellow arrows are just showing the large amount of hemorrhage which developed around the heart. So finally, allow me to summarize that what I've done in addition to the overview of what our program does is to give you some kind of an overview of the study to date, although I would again stress that it's very much works in progress. We have very limited hard data so far, I'm afraid. However, we are pleased to note that this is something that you can practically do and other centers could do also, because there are the logistical challenges in transporting, scanning, and performing conventional autopsy, all within that sort of 24-hour period, which the medical examiners really have to work with, because they just have to be able to come to conclusions as the result of what's going on and move on. But clearly, we need to make sure they have the best information available as possible. Our study accrual is clearly less than 50% still and slower than projected, but we're hoping to just keep working at it until we get where we need to go. And in addition of the adult cases, less than 65 years of age may actually help. This is going to be the new medical examiner's office in the for the state of Maryland, which will actually be open in the spring of 2010. It's on the university campus again. It's going to be the first U.S. medical examiner's office to be equipped with a CT scanner, because we actually can justify it both in terms of what we're doing in terms of research, but even more importantly, we can even actually make a good economic argument for having a scanner, because of the fact that it will replace, hopefully, a lot of the conventional autopsy work that's currently taking place. And finally, I do thank you for attention, and hopefully if we have questions, we can deal with them later. Thank you. Thank you.